Short prayer.
We're all set. It's up to you.
Let's take a short break and regroup. Okay, welcome back. We're on to our 1 o'clock agenda item. John.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. This goes back to a response or includes some unfinished business on Amendment 5, but goes beyond that. And how do we provide for industry funding of observer coverage? And Dr. Karp, who's at ICES, and I wrote a letter, which is in your packet, to both this council and the Mid-Atlantic about how we think the best way to proceed is. And as I said earlier, part of what guides us is speed, and how to do this as quickly as possible, and how to solve the problem with herring, but also how to solve it beyond herring. And Susan Gardner and Melissa Hooper are going to give a presentation, but one of the things that I'd want to say just in way of introduction is that part of the problem with the observer language in the herring amendment, there were two problems there that caused us to disapprove that. We want increased observer coverage too. That wasn't the problem. The overall goal we subscribe to. The problems were that you mandated a coverage level 100%, and two, you set a participation rate in industry. You said industry will pay not to exceed 375, and that's not that doesn't cover the ATSI portion. And I know you use the word target, and so what we're trying to. And we have a very limited budget. It's a reality that we have to deal with. And so we're trying to figure out a way forward where industry can contribute through a third party that Susan and Melissa are going to explain, where if industry can contribute 100% of the cost, which might be the case in, and I think was the intention in herring, where if industry could contribute 100% of the cost, that might work. But I think going forward, what would make for an approvable amendment is if the council did not specify either a coverage level like 100%, nor an industry rate of 100% of the cost, but just gave us indications of priority. That would be better in terms of our ability to approve in the future. Now, the other thing in terms of how we might do this in the quickest way possible is our staff would be willing to do the legwork at an omnibus amendment. We would, of course, involve the PDT and the FMAT, because this applies to the Mid-Atlantic as well, of an omnibus amendment like SBRM, and come forward when that's drafted, present it to the council. So we do the heavy lifting of this, get the work done, and present it to you for your approval, and just confine it to how we go about getting industry contributions to observer coverage for the at-sea portion. This still involves us covering the onshore or overhead portions of observer coverage, which is an equal or roughly equal component of the cost. And that that's another reason that causes us, when you mandate a level of coverage like 100% coverage, that's a mandated cost because it forces us to pick up the onshore or overhead, and that because we don't know what our budget is at the time you might pass something, that becomes an automatic, no, we can't approve that plan. That's why if you include language like that in a plan, that's an automatic, no, we can't approve that plan. That's why that's in that advice. And it's not because we don't want to do it. It's because we don't even know when you pass that plan what's in the Science Center budget for observer coverage at that point. So with those, what we're hoping to get at the end of this presentation is you're nodding, your head's nodding, not in dozing off, nodding in assent that we want to go forward with us drafting this omnibus amendment that would provide for industry sharing of costs anywhere from 0%, as has been the case in groundfish, to potentially 100%, as might be the case for healthy fisheries. Okay, with that, Susan Gardner and Melissa Hooper will make a presentation.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Chair. Well, we appreciate the opportunity to be here and open up this conversation to talk in a bit more detail about what John has just described to you, hopefully walk you through any issues that might have caused confusion in the past, and to basically open up the conversation so we can start thinking about the way forward to address this issue that has been so clearly identified as very urgent. What we'd like to do is to develop a universal and flexible solution that enables industry funding, additional coverage above SBRM in multiple FMPs, and to enable NIMFs to help offset industry costs to the extent that is possible with available funding, and we understand the need for this. So as many have alluded to, the agency established a working group on observer funding that was made up of the Science Center, the regional office, general counsel, and Department of Commerce staff to really put our heads together and to figure out the legal issues and other issues that were related to proposed observer cost-sharing measures. And so basically, Melissa and I will be reporting on the recommendations of this working group and a potential path forward to move this further. So first of all, before we discuss any solutions, we have to be very clear when we're talking about observer funding that there's two different components to the cost of observer coverage. And it's always very important to understand those two different components and to make sure that funding is available for both components in order to achieve any desired observer coverage levels. So the first is your basic observer monitoring costs, which include the costs that would be incurred by a service provider, the observer salary, for example, or the travel for the observer. In the case of the groundfish FMP, the industry has a responsibility for these costs. So the costs of obtaining a monitor for a certified provider are already clearly stated. Now, the second component of funding is NIMFS costs for the support and infrastructure related to the monitoring program. This is things like the observer training, infrastructure, providing certification, data processing, things like that, that are costs that are incurred by NIMFS. So when we increase observer coverage, there'll be an increase in both of these different types of costs. And in order to enable councils to use industry funding to increase observer coverage levels in their fisheries, we have to address a couple different issues related to these two different types of costs. So first, let's start with observer monitoring costs, if I've still got everybody with me and I haven't said anything outlandish yet, right? Okay. So first is the legal issues. With observer coverage, funding, it's subject to legal constraints of the Miscellaneous Receipts Act and the Anti-Deficiency Act. So under the existing laws, NIMS and industry cannot share responsibility for observer monitoring costs. That's the law. You can't put that in regulations. Okay? For example, we cannot cap the industry contribution and require NIMS to be responsible for the remainder of the observer monitoring cost. That's just the law. How do you resolve this? Well, it can be resolved with provisions that enable industry to take on the responsibility for the costs of additional coverage. These are provisions that already exist, for example, in sea scallops and multi-species FMP. But they're not in the herring or the mackerel or other fisheries. Okay, the second issue is a technical issue related to once a fishery has full industry-funded monitoring provisions, then it becomes possible for NIMS to help to offset some of the costs when funding is available. However, there doesn't currently, right now, exist a mechanism that enables the agency to do that. And so the working group has been working on what a mechanism like that could be. Okay, so on the second component related to the funding that NIMS incurs for support and infrastructure costs, I think everybody realizes that NIMS funding stream varies annually based on appropriations and is subject to the ebbs and flows of the budget appropriation process, right? That's clear to everybody. Therefore, it's not possible to make specific funding commitments in advance or to specify an explicit funding level in the FMPs. Any increase to observer coverage, even when industry is paying the full cost of the observers, will result in some NIMS incurred additional costs, and NIMS appropriations to cover these costs are limited and they're variable. So therefore, the councils can recommend targets, but cannot mandate specific levels of observer coverage that could impose a financial obligation that might be beyond what is appropriated. I think it'd be really nice if it worked the other way, but it doesn't. So to address these challenges, the working group developed the following recommendation for approach for sort of a transitional short-term approach, a mechanism that was modeled after the Northwest's cost-share program. So the first component is that NIMS would continue to do some of the things that NIMS is currently doing, such as training observers, certifying providers, and processing the data. So there'd be no change in that. There'd be no change in the process that NIMS controls the vessel selection. That would continue as currently working. Industry would be responsible in the FMP regulations for the cost of obtaining observers from a certified provider. Industry would obtain the observers directly from the certified provider. And then NIMS would develop a partnership with a third party who could assist in paying the service provider a cost offset that would be provided by NIMS whenever funding is available. And as a result, the service provider could reduce the cost that's billed to industry. Essentially, this is the model. Working forward, the next steps would be to identify a third party to partner with on a mechanism for offsetting industry costs, to begin to work with the councils. For groundfish, the mechanism would be intended to be implemented possibly already in the next fishing year. For other fisheries that require a mechanism, species other than groundfish could be done possibly through an omnibus amendment. And that's what Melissa is going to walk you through the details and describe for you what that process might look like.
Thank you. So you've heard alluded a few times in the discussion already today this idea of doing an omnibus amendment to address this issue across all fisheries. What we're envisioning is an omnibus that would establish generally a framework for industry-funded monitoring programs moving forward. Specifically, it would define NIMS and industry cost responsibilities for all FMPs and general provisions. This would clarify those cost responsibilities for future actions, which in the past, because in the past this has been a source of confusion, most recently with Herring Amendment 5 and with Framework 48 for groundfish, there's a little confusion about what those cost responsibilities are or could be under the regulations. So we're anticipating that the definition, the responsibilities, would be similar to the definitions that are already in the groundfish and scallop regulations. The second component to the omnibus would be to establish industry funding requirements for all FMPs. To clarify, this would not implement monitoring programs in individual fisheries. It wouldn't specify coverage levels or anything like that. I would simply clarify that based on this cost definition of these cost responsibilities moving forward, if there was an industry-funded monitoring program that was implemented, that the industry would be responsible for paying its component. We have this language already in the groundfish and scallop FMPs, and it would just be extending those regulations to other fisheries. Finally, we've discussed establishing an annual process by which NIMS and both councils could prioritize and set coverage among FMPs to achieve regional monitoring goals. Now, the purpose of this specific measure would be to allow NIMS and the councils to deal with NIMS annual budget constraints. This would allow the councils and the public to participate in an open and transparent prioritization process to inform NIMS allocation decisions when resources are limited. The situation that we've been running into, as you've heard a little bit today and in the letter from John and Bill, is that when budget years are good, we do have the funding to support the infrastructure for additional monitoring coverage, and as you have with groundfish and scallops, the FMPs that have proposed those measures during those years, we've been able to support, but we've been running into issues like with herring that you know, when the funding isn't available, then we can't implement a program that isn't going to be funded because then it's not really being implemented or effective. So we envision that this process could be done through the NRCC or some other joint body. Specific FMPs would set coverage goals or targets and refer back to this process to set the actual coverage rates each year based on funding availability and regional priorities. Specific FMPs would also detail how to handle coverage rate levels that fell short of the target. We'd like to keep the action streamlined, as John said, in order to move it forward quickly. Since it's largely administrative, we think we could do that. But we understand the council wants to address the recent disapproval of observer requirements in Herring Amendment 5, and so the council could include specific coverage targets and goals for the herring fishery in this omnibus as well. So we're suggesting that NIMS staff would take the lead, as we did for the SBRM amendment, and work with the council's joint PDT FMAT that was formed to address this observer monitoring funding issue. And the council could assign additional participants to the PDT FMAT to represent other FMPs. Obviously, the situation isn't ideal, and there's still a lot of work to figure out the details that has to be done. But in this budget climate, even the most optimistic among us has to realize that available funding may not be able to address all of the council's goals. But we think that this plan would allow the council and NIMS the flexibility to make the best of a difficult situation, and it would allow us to work together to prioritize coverage where it is most needed to achieve the highest priority objectives. And it would allow both the council and the public to be informed about funding limitations and to contribute to the decision-making process about trade-offs. So if the council supports this proposal, NIMS staff will begin developing alternatives for the omnibus amendment with a PDT FMAT, and our goal will be to present both councils with initial range of alternatives at the January and February council meetings. And the intent would be that, as Susan said, that we would try to have this effective for future fishing years, hopefully 2015 for herring. So with that, we'll take questions.
Yeah, thank you both. Tom's got a question. We'll go around the council. I see some hands out in the audience.
I guess I have a few process questions about the omnibus amendment approach, and not any. Well, I might have one or two about specific details of the cost sharing approach. So it's my understanding that, for the most part, the idea of the omnibus amendment would be to set up a structure with. That would facilitate industry-funded monitoring. Is that correct? And then the actual implementation of any sort of coverage level above the SBRM coverage levels would be a requirement of a particular FMP and would have to be addressed in a separate FMP action. With the exception that you're proposing, because of the interest in hearing, that somehow the hearing coverage levels would be folded into this particular document.
Yes, that's correct.
So related to that, you know, the initial SBRM, when the initial SBRM was adopted, it was led by NIMS, and there was no public participation in that process. It was entirely in-house. And I guess I think the council may want to think a little bit, and the Mid-Atlantic Council may want to think a little bit, since this is an omnibus, about how committee and public participation would occur. The current SBRM, of course, the FMAT is a little bit more open and has had conference calls and everything like that open, but there have been relatively few meetings. But I think the council may want to consider, if this goes forward, exactly how input will get into this FMAT and how the public process will participate with this FMAT, which I think will be pretty important, particularly if we try and roll in the Hearing Amendment 5 issues into this document. I'll stop there.
Mayor Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had that same, you know, thought process going that Tom just alluded to, and also I was curious about NIMS developing a relationship with a third party that they could pay money to that would offset the industry cost, and if you could just speak to that a little bit more detail on what that really means.
Sure. We were looking at the model that's used in the Northwest cost share program. In that case, they partner with the Pacific States Commission and are able to work with them on a number of things related to providing services for observer providing and working with the observer providers. And that relationship apparently has been very successful. So we're looking at that relationship and trying to identify what might, you know, who might be some adequate partners that we could consider developing something along those lines.
PK.
All right. I have a few questions. Number one, just because I want to walk through a little scenario, what does an average day cost overall? Roughly.
I don't know. I don't have any estimates with me. I've heard for previous groundfish actions what we've talked about. It depends upon the FMP and the design of the program, but sea day, including infrastructure costs, is $1,200, was estimates we've used in groundfish before.
All right. Well, okay. That was But so I'm just going to say 1,000. I know it's probably a lot more than that. I could say 2,000. But so there are two costs to that. There's the NIMS cost and the observer monitoring cost. What percentage of the total cost? Because you said you broke it down into two different costs, correct? Do you know what the percentage is for that? Is it 60-40? Is it 50-50?
No, I don't have those breakdowns. Sorry.
All right, well, that's another good question. And then I've got another question, because if the NIMS cost is, say, 40%, and the observer monitoring cost, which the industry has to take care of, is 60%, that's where it depends on that ratio, because that's where there's a problem, because you're talking about offsetting some of the observer monitoring costs, which the industry has to fund, has to pay for, through a third party based on the budget, you know, NIMS's budget. And that's where I have a problem, because that's a floating target. And number one, we don't know what the percentage is, and that's a floating target. And I can argue, you know, fishing is a floating target every day. We don't know how much money we're going to make. So is it going to be $200, and is it going to be $700? I mean, we don't have a budget. So that's a huge issue. So those got to be ironed out. then I have another question is do so the NIMS has to pick up in part of their cost the observer training portion. Do we know what the I mean, to me, it seems like just when I was fishing, I mean, there were different observers all the time. It seems like that cost is pretty high. It seems like you're retraining new observers all the time. So just a suggestion, and I don't know what that would be, but it seems like that cost must be high, and somehow that has to be lowered by keeping the same observers or just something, just a consideration. Thank you.
Ellen.
I'm seeing lots of little red flags popping up over your heads. Or maybe red. I have several questions and more forming in my head at the moment. Do you envision industry being able to pick from a group of providers, or will this third party be writing contracts?
No, I think the way we envision it is how it is designed in the Amendment 16 program for sectors, which is they would be contracting directly with the providers and could choose their providers among whoever was certified by NIMS.
So this is going to work similar to the past dockside monitoring program? That was a total disaster. I'm seeing more red flags. And how much do you envision the third-party provider requiring in payment that would increase the cost of this proposal?
So the third party... Mm-hmm. There's a third party, and then there's the observer provider. So
right.
I don't know if I made clear
oh, yeah.
that you could contract with the observer provider, and the third party would not have any influence over that contract. The third party
they have to be paid.
Presumably would have some overhead. They typically do. That's how it worked for the grant for the dockside monitoring program as well for those reimbursements. Depending upon who it is, we don't know what that rate would be, but that would be built into the planned distribution of funding for that program.
So who would be paying for that, NIMS or the industry?
If the offset is coming from NIMS, it would come off the top of that before it was applied. That's typically how it works. But the third party would never be collecting money from the industry or billing the industry for anything.
Okay. Since the monitoring program... the dockside and the monitoring program that we have right now has some severe problems. How will this omnibus deal with complaints and issues between industry and the providers?
Well, so the omnibus isn't going to implement monitoring programs or monitoring requirements for any fisheries unless the council would like it to address it for specifically for herring because of the Amendment 5 disapprovals. So individual FMPs that want to implement monitoring programs could address all of those issues in their individual FMPs actions.
That's not what I wanted to hear. I think it should be in the omnibus. It should be in front of everyone before we even start the process so that we have some input to the final outcome and to making sure that the program works. I'm really uncomfortable with everything that I've heard today. Thank you.
Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to see if I have this straight. Now, you started talking about training, right? The service is going to pay for the training of the observers, correct? And then you went to the data collection, and you're going to take care of that component also. And then there was the provider, right? So now we're at the three steps. And then there would be the at-sea monitor, which the industry would be responsible for. Is that correct? And if a budget allowed, you'd try to subsidize that some way, or did I miss it? So I've got that all right. I'm really trying to figure out what's the third party doing and what's it going to cost.
one of the challenges in arrangements, like I said before, we can't have both an agency and an industry share responsibilities. And so once the responsibility is firmly with the industry, then there needs, if the agency has funding to be able to contribute and help offset those costs, there needs to be some kind of a mechanism to do that. This third-party mechanism has worked well in the Northwest and is a model that we've been using that already exists so that we would not have to be reinventing a new wheel. So it would be a some sort of a grant or contract or arrangement of some sort, an agreement, where we could be working with someone that would take that role for us, as well as perhaps in the case of the Northwest, they have a number of other responsibilities that provide a service and a benefit broadly to the public.
Vincent.
I understand that. Now, you couldn't use the provider for that because you directly pay them and then they work with the industry. Is that what you're trying to say? Because why couldn't the provider be that source?
So that's where it starts to get into the issue of us sharing responsibility, and we can't contract with a provider if the industry also contracts with a provider for the same services. So this is the mechanism that we've been able to identify where we could still provide some assistance without getting into the issues with the Anti-Deficiency Act and other statutes. So.
Okay, thank you.
Tom.
Thanks. I wanted to start, I have to have a couple points because we've heard a couple things, and a lot of them, I think, as Ellen said, raise some red flags. First and foremost, I think it's important to remember what we asked for and what we voted almost unanimously through Amendment 5, and that wasn't for a 325-day cost not to exceed that amount. It was a target, and we discussed that. A target is not a cap. And anyone who thinks that those things are the same probably doesn't balance checkbooks or set budgets at their house. Like, those words mean different things, and words, the meaning of words has to, it has to be recognized. And I don't care how many times somebody says, well, the council voted for a hard cap on at a per-day level at 325. That's simply not true. I have the motion in front of me from the 20th in 2012. This is over a year ago. We voted for a target per-day cost. I mean, I just don't see the problem. So moving on from that, I guess the bigger issue for me here, and unfortunately we're dealing with this at the end of a very long meeting, and I understand that everybody's pretty worn out, but this is a fundamental change to the roles and responsibilities of the council and the agency, as I see it. I mean, we're only talking about observer coverage here, but what I hear is, we're not allowed to make any management change that would result in an, or could result in an even marginal cost increase to the bureaucracy of NIMS. I mean, we could talk, and we are talking today about observer costs, but this is the same with VMS costs, with creating a sub-ACL and tracking that sub-ACL. I mean, it seems like a tremendous shift in responsibilities. And I just don't agree with the NIMS position that says you can't require an observer. You can't require an at-sea monitor for a fishery. And we'll go through this SBRM process. And I don't defer to their better judgment. And I think it's the role of this council to set out exactly what a fishery needs to be managed sustainably and put that into the fishery management plan. And I think we did that pretty responsibly in Amendment 5. So the idea that, well, there's no, it's not possible to have an observer requirement in any fishery ever. What is possible is you could tell us that you want it higher than SBRM, and then we'll sort of decide whether that's feasible, and we'll sort of rank that in a list, and then we'll see what we can get to you. That's not how we manage, and that's not the role of this council as I see it. I think the role of this council as a stakeholder body is to identify what a fishery needs, what our fisheries need to meet our objectives. This seems significant, and I think it extends past just observer coverage. And I don't think that this is the first time that we've had budget uncertainty since this law was enacted. and we haven't made this kind of wholesale change. We haven't handcuffed councils in this way, and we haven't stopped progress, needed progress in our fisheries in this way. So I'm very uncomfortable with this whole concept.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your presentation there. I had two questions. One involved what the third party actually has to do, and I think you answered that very well with Vince's question. It sounds like they just simply launder the money for a fee. But my other question is, you talked about looking for potential third parties. Are there guidelines or legal requirements for what constitutes an acceptable third party?
I'm not aware of any guidelines that exist in terms of what would be an acceptable third party. It is not our view that this would be a role that would be, as you described it, laundering and moving money. We would see a real public benefit to the work that this third party would do and the service that they would provide. And so we would be looking for someone, institution to partner with that could provide that service.
John.
I'm sorry that we're limited by resources. I say that 2 days before, you know, we may all be going home. The option, I guess, when you say you want to mandate 100% coverage is, I guess we can do that. You know, if we don't have the money, just people don't leave the dock. I don't know whether that was your intention, but that is what happens. When you say spend money that we don't have, you can't do that. And so we turn down a plan when you tell us spend money that we don't have. It's not that we don't like to do it. It's just we can't do it. And so the only other option is, well, if there's a requirement and we don't have the money, people don't leave the dock. If that's your intention, then that can be made more explicit. Now, I think to the point that some unanswered questions make people uncomfortable, let's remember, this is the beginning of the process. You're asking to see a plan when we're saying we'd like to do the plan. We don't have the plan. We'd like to do the plan. And the only other point I would make, and I think the chair or Tom may have mentioned this, is about the issue of public input. And that is that there is a line between speed and public input. We can have lots of public input and take time doing public input, and we can do it all behind closed doors and be really fast, have no public input. Neither one of those is the right answer, right? So the SBRM, I think, had a lot of public input built in at the beginning. So we gathered a lot of public input, and there wasn't a lot of public input in the technical part of it. So the same thing might be done here, where you build in public input at the beginning to get people's ideas how this might work. And then when you have that public input, you get the technical aspects working. But what Susan and Melissa are trying to describe is we're at the outset of a planning purpose trying to say, here's how a planning process might work, not that we have the plan and all the answers. We would go about getting these answers if you want us.
Mike.
Yeah, my comments may be somewhat along the same lines as John's. I would say that having dealt with things like this for 30 years of my life, you don't underestimate the value of a good money laundry. They're actually quite important if you're going to get things done. You know, I agree with the point John just made. This is obviously intended to be the beginning of a process. My only frustration is that it's sort of the restart of a process that's been started many times before and hasn't succeeded. I can think of about 20 years of starting processes like this that haven't succeeded, and I think the key is that We have to go into this one committed to make it successful. I hear all the red flags, and I can see lots of things that I could raise red flags about. But we do have a statement that it actually does exist and works on the West Coast. So there's at least a model that gives us something to think positively about, and I think we just have to go forward and try to make it successful. To be very blunt, my observation about discussions of this type around the country over a lot of years is that maybe they are more successful in the West Coast because they always do go into that discussion expecting that to be the outcome rather than expecting the opposite. So I would just urge that we try to make this work. Thank you.
Mary Beth? Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the effort that the service has undertaken to come up with a workaround on this issue. But even looking optimistically at the tea leaves, I think we can anticipate that Amendment 14 could have a similar outcome with the mackerel fishery. So as we think about an omnibus approach, we'll likely have to fold that into it as well if there's specific concerns about the mackerel fishery as we go forward. So that's something that I just want to mention now. And I appreciate this as a proposed solution, but I think ultimately the most durable solution may come in the approach that the North Pacific Council has written into the Act, and that resides in Section 313 of the Act, thanks to Senator Stevens. And that includes the establishment of a fishery observer fund. It allows the North Pacific Council to establish a system of fees that would be used to govern observer coverage, et cetera. So there's very specific authority that resides in the Act for the benefit of the management of North Pacific fisheries, and something along those lines might give us a more secure platform from which to address these issues in the future. So I just offer that for thought as we are in a season of Magnuson reauthorization. I did mention the fact that we need to secure the ability to have cost-sharing programs in the Act in my written testimony, but want to just mention that for thought for the council. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion from the council? Tom?
I guess I view this response in part, sorry, I view this presentation in part as a response to a letter that I think I sent the regional office back in June or maybe early July, where I asked some questions based on the disapproval of Amendment 5 and Framework 48 monitoring measures. I asked some questions about how are we going to move forward here, because supposedly there had been an FMAT formed. We had not heard any progress on the FMAT since February, and yet each time these things were disapproved, the language said, oh, the FMAT's working on this. So I was a little frustrated with that and sent the letter over to the agency. I think I managed to disguise the frustration in the letter pretty well. And I actually think this shows some potential promise for us. I think there's a lot of issues that we're probably going to have to work through. I think the public participation one is in there as well that we have to be careful about. But it seems to me like modeled after the Pacific Groundfish Plan, we may have a way to figure out how to share the costs of these programs, and then it'll be up to each FMP to figure out the details of what the requirements are. And I don't think those are going to be easy, but I think we've got to get started on that. I guess what I'm concerned about is that we're hoping that this will be done, I guess, and in place, in early, 2014, and I think that timeline seems a little bit optimistic to me, and that's the only thing that makes me a little bit nervous as to how we're going to deal with that. But I would hope that, the council would give some kind of indication about whether they, at least a head bob, that we want to move forward on this.
Before we do any head bobbing, there are some comments. Gib and Dave, and then I guess we're going to come back and move this along.
Thank you.
See you, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. I appreciate this. Industry funding is one of those black boxes, and it sounds like you folks are taking steps to to shine some light on it. There are a couple of things, as you gave your description about this, that raised some red flags for me. In particular, the description of a prioritization process going with the council and the public and the agency. And I'm wondering how that's going to play in with the SBRM, because that element of the original SBRM was the grounds for the vacation of the SBRM by the court, and that there was too much discretion given to the agency to do that kind of thing. The new SBRM that's being developed was developed specifically to address that and take that discretion away and lay out a set process to deal with budgetary shortfall, insufficient resources, or something to that effect. And so I'm wondering, is the prioritization process that you were describing, is that above and beyond the SBRM? And when all of the SBRM needs are met by agency funding, then that would go into effect? Is that...
Sorry, we'll play musical microphones here. Yes, that's correct. It would be above and beyond statutory requirements.
Okay, now my concern is, since the original SBRM went into effect, that insufficient resource clause has been invoked each and every year. We have not had a year since the SBRM went into effect that there has been sufficient resources to fully fund the SBRM coverage that was prescribed by the analysis. So I'm wondering, unless something changes significantly and there are significant new resources brought to the situation, is that element ever going to come into play? Does that need to be considered in this development of this new omnibus? The other thing is the timeline that the executive director just mentioned about implementing this in potentially in 2014. That's right in line with implementation or the planned implementation of the new SBRM omnibus. And there seems to be a tremendous amount of overlap, and I think that two very, very similar omnibus actions about observer coverage, they should be at the very least done in close consultation with one another, if not integrated with one another, to make sure that they don't butt heads with each other when they're finally done. So I would encourage the council and the agency to consider coordinating those two efforts to make sure that they're smooth and that they consider each other's findings. So we're following the SBRM process real carefully, and this new wrinkle in here causes some concern. So we hope that it's all taken care of. Thanks very much.
Dave.
Hi, David Gaethel. Thank you for informative presentation. You mentioned two acts that constrain you. Could you give me those names again?
It's the Anti-Deficiency Act and the Miscellaneous Receipts Act.
I want to look these up and learn something about them. Are these something that if we went to Congress and say, can we get an exemption from them, have you looked at that as a possibility? Or does it have to be asked for from somebody outside the agency?
I would describe that as unlikely, but happy to defer to legal counsel for more details.
Yep, Mitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was what Rick Robbins was alluding to. There was a specific statutory provision for the Pacific Northwest program that allowed them to collect fees and to use those towards the observer program. So that was, in effect, an exemption. It wasn't worded like that, as I recall it. But so that has been done, and that's a precedent for that.
Okay, thank you. After I read these, I'll probably be on the hotline to Congress. The second question I have is, have you looked at taking this program back in-house and running it out of the science center. And, you know, instead of having two bureaucracies, and now it sounds like we're going to have three bureaucracies. You know, we only had one bureaucracy. At least we could get rid of two of the bureaucracies. Is that possible?
It generally hasn't been the model that we've used in this region and other regions around the country. It would involve the creation of a whole bunch of infrastructure within the Northeast Fisheries Science Center that perhaps we're not able to undertake, at least in the short term.
Okay, well, I hope it would at least be looked at because it might be a cheaper alternative. At least it might be simpler, too. Not, it may not be simpler for you, but it might be simpler in the long run. And the third thing I didn't hear anybody mention in this discussion is, where is the incentive for any of these companies or the bureaucracy on the government side to reduce costs? It sounds like everything just gets passed along to the boats. You know, what provision would be put in here for the industry to help control the cost? Because this program seems to have runaway costs at the moment.
Tom wants a crack at that one.
Well, I'm not sure how our program would set up. I would point out that the West Coast Groundfish Program has, I think, four or five authorized providers that the vessels deal with directly themselves when they hire them, even though they're paid through the funding source. So there's at least the possibility of competition when you're choosing which provider to hire, which may reduce costs. Now, I don't know that it has, but it seems like that's at least a possibility.
Follow up to that, Mike?
Well, even if there's only one certified provider, they have to go through a competitive bid process to get certified at the initial stage, which is a way to compete for costs. Doesn't necessarily reduce costs to the level that you would like to see because of, frankly, lots of things that go on in terms of government procurement and so on. But nevertheless, there is a competitive process in any of these systems that I know of because at least at some stage they have to compete.
Russ?
Yeah, I think in a sense, competition between these companies is one potential for driving down costs. And we've actually seen a little bit of that as we've gotten more providers to sort of participate in terms of providing observers. For me, looking in from the outside of the program, probably one of the best ways that you could reduce cost would be to reduce turnover of observers. So, and that's something that I know that our observer program is very focused on. I think it's something that industry should be concerned about. If you just look from a business sense, it costs a great deal of money when you start turning over your employees in terms of retraining employees, in terms of them being productive and things like that. So anytime you run a business enterprise, and the observer program is a business enterprise, if you can reduce that turnover and have people stay longer, that absolutely would reduce cost.
And I agree with you, Russ. I mean, what I would say is I would hope that at some level in the review of these contracts or service providers or whatever that you put some industry representatives in this program to help review it and to help you control costs, because we see things on the boats a lot of times that we think are driving these costs to be excessive in New England versus the Pacific Northwest or the West Coast in general seems to have much cheaper observer costs than we do. And I think the turnover rate is certainly part of it, and there are probably a lot of other things, but this is kind of a black box for us because we can't see inside these contracts. So we would have probably a lot more faith in the process, if you will, if we had industry people involved in setting this up on the inside.
Yeah, one of the key differences between the East Coast and the West Coast is sort of the average duration of trips. We have a lot of trips that are day trips that are short-term trips, and that actually drives up the average cost, you know, per sea day across the entire program versus in the North Pacific, where you might put an observer on a big processor boat for 20 days or 25 days or something like that. So that's one of the cost drivers. That's a difference between the West Coast and the East Coast.
Right, and I think don't they also have small boats are exempted from a lot of their observer programs? I get the various programs confused. Maybe that's Canada, but I somebody on the Northwest has, like, you know, 50 feet and under, they don't bother with her or something like that, whereas we're trying to cover everybody, as you said, and that's driving, you know, putting an awful lot of people on an awful lot of boats to catch a very little amount of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to your question. Bill would have.
Okay, considering the time, John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congratulations on your election. I've only been here 5 hours today, and I'm already exhausted, so you all should look forward to getting away at some point. I don't want to take up too much time. I just wanted to make a couple of comments with regard to the letter that we're discussing. I just want to say to John Bullard and to Bill Karp, thank you. I wish we had that letter back in 2008 when I was chairing the council and we initiated the herring amendment that we talked about earlier today. Certainly would have been very helpful. But the reason I want to thank you is for taking the time, understanding there's an issue here that's not unique. It will be repeated over and over. There's a very real need, and for putting your staffs together and taking the time to put that letter together and develop a way forward. So that's leadership, and that's something we need in New England, and I just wanted to thank you for that. I'm going to hold back comments on what I think of the solution or the choice that you've offered to the council. I'm not going to share with you what my gut reaction was when I read it on my computer, because I've heard a little bit more today. And, you know, these are tough choices, and I understand that we all understand you're limited in how much money you have. Okay? I think looking at the Pacific Northwest as an example of how things could be done differently is a good way forward. However, as we know, the Pacific Northwest is a lot different than New England or the Mid-Atlantic. I believe the majority of their fisheries are catch-share fisheries. I believe the majority of them have been rationalized, and I believe the majority of them are very profitable compared to New England. And so, not even talking about the specific Section 313 in Magnuson, but just thinking about this concept of cost-sharing makes it very difficult for, whether or not we can do it or not, it makes it very difficult for the council and the regional office to put something in regulations from year to year, right, that has a mandate like that, knowing that we don't have consistently profitable fisheries, and we don't have consistently robust budgets, and the trends we're looking at right now are difficult as well. I tend to look at or think that the solutions lie above us here in this room. The solutions lie above our respective agencies. I mean, this is an issue that's symptomatic of the Magnuson Act right now. And I think the laundry list of things we had to do was very long before it was recently reauthorized. It got even longer, okay? And there was a temporary period where your budget was enhanced or supplemented to help get through the initial push of going through ACLs. That was what I did when I was chair, is basically bully through ACLs and AMs in whatever fashion we could, because that was the mandate, right? But now they're pulling back on the purse strings, and they're saying good luck with that one. And so just as a general statement, we're going to continue to ram our heads into a variety of different walls because we're not going to be able to implement the mandates. We're going to have to start pulling back on conservation measures we've taken, or we're going to have to look the other way. right? And I don't think anybody here wants to look the other way. I think everybody here comes to work every day or comes to these meetings and sits at these at this table with the idea of making things better, making them better in the ocean, making them better for each vessel owner, making them better for crew, making them better for the communities that depend on these resources. That's why we do this, right? And so we only have what we have. And I think one of the ways forward is to, in our various capacities and through our various soapboxes that we all have, to start talking loudly about the fact that the jobs that you've asked us to do is a job that needs to be done, but you've got to support us in doing it. So I appreciate the efforts that you all have put in to providing the council with a solution or a potential way forward. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be satisfied with the result, and it's not because you didn't try and we didn't try. So I look forward to this discussion as it moves forward over the next few months, and pray to God that something changes and we can fully implement the Magnuson Act and enjoy the efforts that we've put forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Bringing this back to the council and hoping to wrap up this discussion, acknowledging all the concerns raised by both the public and around the table, is there an objection to the agency developing? Tom, you have an objection.
Well, I have an objection to, I think we're conflating two issues here. This is great. I mean, I don't object to moving forward here, but I think we're making the solution to Amendment 5 a lot more difficult than it needs to be. I mean, Amendment 5 required created a requirement for an at-sea monitor, a requirement. And if you don't fulfill a requirement, you don't go fishing. So, yes, you are tied up to the dock. Amendment 5 also created an approval process for third-party providers. So the industry could contract directly with a third-party provider, no government involved, to fulfill their requirement for an at-sea monitor for that trip so that they could go fishing, just like they're required to have VMS or a life raft or anything else. It is a requirement. There were absolutely issues to work out with regards to how we were going to do that. Staff, the council, all understood that. That's why we were talking about an FMAP process. And as Tom highlighted earlier, that never really got off the ground. So this big expansive effort, I don't object to that, but that's not what's required to get Amendment 5 done. We all say we want the quickest, most straightforward, practical solution so that we can get this coverage on the water, the accountability we all want. We don't need this process. This is a 4 or 5 year process, and it's great, but we don't need it. All we need to figure out is we need to recommit. A requirement for an observer is a requirement. $325 a day is a target. It costs what it costs, just like a life raft or your VMS service. And that we have third-party providers, and we have a system in place. The industry has to contract with those. There are details to work out. This is a different process, and maybe a good one, but definitely a different one and not required to move forward with Amendment 5. I just don't agree with conflating these two issues.
Mary Beth.
Well, I think that the process of a proposed rule and a final rule has taken place. There's been an interpretation of what the council meant, and I think the intent of the council was very clear that they'd like to see, 100% observer coverage in the herring fishery at an affordable cost. That was what the discussion was. And we can't undo that. I mean, you might not agree with it. There's parts of the final rule I don't agree with, but I can't undo those. It is what it is. And so I think what we need to do is to figure out how to move forward. And the agency has come forward with a proposal that get us moving in the right direction, and I truly appreciate that. And I would hope that the outcome of something like this would be that we'd have, a methodology for industry to cost share with the agency, that this council would prioritize the highest level possible in the herring fishery under this plan, and that we get 100% observer coverage on the water. And if that's what it takes, I think that's what we need to do. I mean, there's been, a lot of comparisons. What do they do in the North Pacific? What do they do in the Northwest? Well, I can tell you, in the North Pacific, on a vessel, you know, catcher processor vessels that are grossing $20 million plus per year are paying $700 a day for two observers on deck. And a scallop boat in New Bedford pays more than that. And so it's not just about what people think. It's about, you know, the value of these businesses and what is affordable. And I think this actually is a process that could address herring up front quick compared to some of the other issues, and also, you know, be a benefit to the groundfish fishery and any other fishery in the region that is going to need to move forward with industry-funded programs. I mean, we need to do something. And so I think that this is a way forward, and I appreciate that. The only thing I would want to clarify is there was mention of perhaps some council membership, if I'm not confused, in the FMAP PDT process. And if that's the intent, I think that would be at least a good way forward.
John.
I think we would certainly like to get consensus, or however you want to do it, Mr. Chair, to move forward developing this omnibus amendment, and we will work with the PDT, the FMAT from the Mid-Atlantic, and whomever else you want to have us work with, and if you have suggestions on any other type of public process to gather input into this, either suggestions made now or in the future, we'll take those suggestions to incorporate ideas. We would love to get that instruction. And I think our goal will be to move forward as expeditiously as possible to develop this, because we do think this is very important for all kinds of reasons. I think our work, if we get this approval, does not preclude Tom or anyone else from bringing forward the tabled motion. If you want to say that while we're working on this, you know, that you want to prevent anyone from leaving the dock without 100% observer coverage, you know, until they have, you know, that's something you can debate later on. That motion was tabled, and it'll be brought up at the November meeting. If you want to address the specific issue of spillover, which was another issue that we disapproved, that is a specific issue that's not dealt with in this. Although observer coverage would, increased observer coverage would deal in some way with spillover. But that is also an issue that we disapproved. It's also a serious issue, and this council could deal in a very focused way with the issue of spillover, and we would cooperate with you on that. Is there a technical fix on that where we could home in on that issue as well? So I don't want to forget that issue either. And if there were just a technical fix on that, could we do that quickly? That's a separate issue related to observer, but we could attack that one separately as well. So, but the issue before us right now is if we have a consensus or sense of the meeting to go forward, any suggestions on who besides the PDT and the Mid-Atlantic FMAT to work with, then we'll go ahead and work as fast as we can on this.
Mary Beth.
Just one thought on that. When you think about the cost of the programs, the third-party providers are a significant, you know, contributor to costs, and it might, you know, serve us all well to perhaps include some of them in those discussions.
John, just for clarification, you mentioned slippage. I think you meant you said spillover. I think you meant slippage. Yeah, that's the end of the day. Okay. Is there an objection? And if there is, then we're going to need a motion to what's the sense of the council? You comfortable with the agency moving this ahead?
You want to
They're nodding. I think you've worn them down. Okay. Thank you, Melissa and Susan. Melissa, you've got another presentation. Can you put it on turbo mode?
Okay, so I'll keep this brief. My presentation is actually pretty brief. Actually pretty brief.